We were almost back to our car. We saw grandparents with two little girls just starting out on the hike. They were only 100 feet from the parking lot when we heard one of the girls whining, "I want to go back to the car!" We could tell this wasn't the first time she said it. The grandfather told her, "We are going back to the car, just as soon as we see the pictures on the rocks." Matt and I are very familiar with the "I want to go back to the car" whine, which is usually followed by the "I can't walk anymore" wail. That's the point when our kids would go limp, making us carry or drag their dead weight back to the car. It's amazing how a 40-pound kid can make herself seem twice as heavy when she doesn't want to do something. On our way back to Hilo, we stopped at the Mauna Loa Nut Factory, hoping to get free macadamia nut samples. They told us that we'd have to take the tour to sample the nuts, which sounded like too much effort for a nut. We wandered around the nut store until Matt started doing his imitation of Harlan Pepper, Christopher Guest's character from Best in Show, naming nuts: peanut, hazelnut, cashew nut, macadamia nut, pine nut, walnut, pistachio nut, red pistachio nut. He does the accent and everything. All day long, we looked forward to having dinner at Ken's House of Pancakes. On their reader board, they advertise coconut pancakes and coconut syrup. Even though the coconut is no longer dedicating its life to us, and we realized we weren't in a healthy relationship with Coco Lopez, we couldn't resist. Tomorrow we're heading to Maui to visit the other Hawaiian National Park, Haleakala. Your friend, Karen.
From Matt Smith. Subject: Number 39, Haleakala National Park. Date: December 8, 2010. Dear Bob and Sue, Karen and I visited Haleakala National Park before. We came to Maui 8 years ago to celebrate our 20th wedding anniversary and got up early on the morning of the big day to drive to the park. Not realizing before the trip that it would be cold at the top of the mountain, we hadn't packed any warm clothes, so we stopped at Walmart to buy sweatshirts on our way to the park. While there, we ate breakfast at McDonald's. As we were eating, Karen took my hand and said, 20 years ago, I couldn't have imagined that you would take me to a McDonald's inside a Walmart for our 20th wedding anniversary. Thank you for making all my dreams come true. What I remember about the park from before is the long drive up the mountain, the drop in temperature when we got to the visitor center, and the silver swords. A silver sword is a plant that grows at high elevations in Hawaii. It can live up to 50 years and blooms only once, and then it dies. We didn't hike in the crater on that visit, and later we regretted it. Today we hiked in the crater. The road to the park is a twisting climb through open range. I had to watch my speed. Several times there were cattle in the road just around a hairpin turn. Whenever we stop for cattle in the road, Karen rolls down her window and talks to them. Mostly she asks them questions. What are you doing in the road? Are you supposed to be in the road? Does your mother know you're in the road? They have yet to answer her. She never tires of seeing them. She considers them a wildlife sighting, which is odd because she considers deer in the road a nuisance. Once we reached the park, we saw several signs depicting a silhouette of a large bird with chicks following behind. The signs were cautioning us to watch for nenes, a goose native to Hawaii. They're sort of the park mascot. The park passport stamp has a nene on it. We didn't see any, but we were watching for them. At the Haleakala Visitor Center, we asked a ranger for hiking suggestions. She gave us a trail map that looked like it was a copy of a copy of a copy. Someone needs to find the original. We decided to take the Sliding Sands Trail to a point 3 miles out for a total of a 6-mile round-trip hike. Karen asked the ranger, "How long should it take us to do that hike?" The ranger said, 3 to 4 hours. "That seems long. 6 miles usually takes us about 2 hours." I recognized Karen's tone. It's the one she uses when telling the person who is answering her that they have not given the correct response and they get one more try. The ranger replied to Karen slowly, as if talking to a 10-year-old. "You need to remember that it will take 2 to 3 times longer to hike back up than it will to hike down." This had the same effect as saying to her, "Biking the Shark Valley Loop is hard. You better take the tram." Karen decided right then we would do the 6-mile hike in 2 hours or die trying. The trail started at the visitor center and dropped steadily for 1,400 feet on its way to the Kalu'uokao'o cinder cone. By the way, it took me 20 minutes to figure out how to type the correct symbols for this name. The Park Service doesn't call the crater a crater anymore. They call it an erosion zone. The landscape in the erosion zone looks like a different planet. It's what I imagine Mars would look like up close, but with silver swords here and there. The 3 miles down took us an hour. From the visitor center, the cinder cone hadn't looked very far away, but the distance was deceptive. The constantly changing clouds, the view of the ocean, the colors of the cinders, it was all very dramatic and beautiful. Regardless, Karen was intent on making it back to the visitor center in an hour. At our turnaround point, there was a couple with a young boy who was in the midst of a meltdown. He had enough of the Sliding Sands Trail and was letting everyone within a half a mile know about it. We shuddered as we walked by and heard their attempts to calm him down. The mom and dad were shivering and protecting their faces from the cold wind as they tried to interest the boy in, well, we're not sure what. There's nothing that could interest a 3-year-old in this vast, empty landscape. We're also not sure how they got him back to the car. Every time they picked him up, he arched his back and kicked. Note to self, don't take small kids on a long hike in an extinct volcano crater. I mean, erosion zone. Maui may be a tropical island, but at 9,000 feet, it's cold. The temperature was maybe 50 degrees, and the wind was steady at 30 miles per hour. We froze our asses off. I don't remember being colder on any other hike on our parks trip. While hiking back up, we knew the faster we went, the sooner we would be warm and out of the wind, but our lungs were burning. Still, there was no stopping or slowing down. Karen was the one who had us on a death march this time. When we got to the parking lot, we'd been gone for 2 hours and 10 minutes. It was time to hit the beach. It wasn't a long visit to the park, but we took care of business. The next couple of days we'll spend at sea level, and then fly home on Saturday. Your friend, Matt.
From Karen Smith, subject number 40, Sahuaro National Park, date January 19, 2011. Dear Bob and Sue, I was embarrassed after I picked up the newsletter at the Sahuaro National Park Visitor Center and realized we'd been pronouncing the name of the park incorrectly. There it was, in huge font for us to sound out. Sahuaro. Matt and I have been calling it Sahuaro. We forgot the rule that G-U-A is pronounced like wa, with heavy breathing. And to think we each completed 4 years of high school Spanish. We probably should have spent more time studying and less time at fiestas con cerveza. A saguaro is what most people probably picture in their minds when they think of a cactus. Tall, green, with arms on the side that sweep up. Taco Time's Ned is a saguaro. Every time you look in the park, there are thousands of them, some as tall as 50 feet. I think they look like armies of soldiers protecting the park, but actually it's the other way around. The park is protecting them. Harming a saguaro in any way is illegal by state law in Arizona. And when houses or highways are built, special permits must be obtained to move a saguaro. Every 10 years, they surveyed the number of saguaros in the park. In 2010, it was estimated that there were 1,896,030 saguaros, up from 1,624,821 saguaros in 2000. Saguaro National Park has two units on opposite sides, east and west, of Tucson. We started on the east side, which is called the Rincon Mountain District. They've built an extensive, well-marked network of hiking trails. As we were hiking, an animal the size of a coyote streaked across our path and stopped. It was the biggest jackrabbit we've ever seen, straight out of Alice in Wonderland. Its ears were at least a foot long. Later, we saw a family of javelinas crossing the road, big ones with their little ones. Many people who live here think javelinas are a nuisance, but to me, they seem very sweet. As we drove out of the park, we saw a dead javelina on the side of the road. I'd like to think it was a grandparent javelina who died peacefully of old age, but Matt said that it was probably run over by someone whose wife complains when he swerves for animals in the road. On our second day, we headed farther out of town to the west unit of the park, called the Tucson Mountain District. We climbed Wasson Peak, the highest mountain in the district, at 4,687 feet. It was a great 8-mile round-trip hike, with amazing views of the desert to the north. We thought we might see a Gila monster, but the only animal we ran into on the trail was an off-leash German Shepherd. I found some helpful information about Gila monsters on a Welcome to Tucson website. A Gila monster is one of only two venomous lizards in the world. Most of a Gila monster's teeth come equipped with two small grooves that conduct the venom deeper into their victim's wound. The venom is a nerve toxin. The toxin is not injected, as it is with a snake bite, but instead flows freely into the wound as the lizard continues to gnaw and chew on its victim. While the bite-delivered toxin can overpower the Gila monster's enemies and prey, it's rarely fatal to humans, even though it's as potent as the venom of the western diamondback rattlesnake. It is, however, quite painful and has other negative and undesirable effects. Gila monsters lock themselves tightly onto whatever, or whomever, they bite, and when bone is included in the bite, they can hang on for an extremely long time and be difficult to remove. If it does remain firmly attached to a body part, there are several ways to remove it safely from the victim. You can try to detach the lizard by prying its mouth open with a stick or pen or any other similar object. Or use a lighter or matches to put heat directly under its jaw. If there is a suitable body of water present, or a bucket or tub of water, you can immerse the lizard until it releases. Finally, if none of these methods work, you can try my personal favorite, which the website warns to use only as a very last resort. You can grab the animal very firmly by the tail, and with a swift, powerful motion, pull it off. This is not advisable, as there will almost surely be extensive damage to the victim. I was very concerned after reading these facts about Gila monsters, because even though Matt is well prepared for an emergency, he doesn't have a lighter or matches or a bucket or tub of water in his backpack. If the situation arises, I'm pretty sure he would use the grab-and-yank method to remove a Gila monster from my body. After making it safely down Wasson Peak, with all body parts intact, we went to the Signal Hill picnic area where we ate our lunch and looked at the petroglyphs that the Hohokam Indians pecked into stone. The interpretive sign said these drawings could have been made as far back as A.D. 300. However, I think the "Do It" petroglyph may have been a little more recent. We've had a great time here in the Tucson area. Besides exploring the national park, we also hiked in Sabino Canyon, which is part of Coronado National Forest. We love being out hiking in the sun every day rather than hibernating in the Seattle rain. We can feel our vitamin D levels increasing already. It's also inspiring to see so many older people here who are active, physically fit, and enjoying life. And the Mexican food and margaritas are muy bueno. Tomorrow we're driving to Palm Springs to visit Joshua Tree National Park. Su amiga, Karen.
From Matt Smith. Subject, number 41. Joshua Tree National Park. Date, January 24th, 2011. Dear Bob and Sue, Karen told me twice today that I was being rude. My personal best is three times in one day, so I'm staying up late just in case I get one more opportunity to match the record. We visited Joshua Tree National Park today. Our first hike was to the top of Ryan Mountain, a three-mile round trip. This is the highest point in the park at 5,458 feet. The hike to the peak was fairly steep. We were breathing hard on the way up. The trail wound in and out of the sun. It was windy, but not as windy as yesterday. I was hot and cold at the same time for much of the hike. Karen seemed to be fine. At the peak, there's a 360-degree view of the park and the surrounding beautiful and desolate desert. The top of Ryan Mountain is not a large area. In the center, there's a pile of rocks about 10 feet tall. It's the highest place on the mountain. From the top of the rock pile, you can see in all directions. Sitting at the base of the rocks was a guy talking on a cell phone. It was clear from his conversation that he was on a conference call, which was good because that's what we were hoping for, to come to a national park in the middle of the desert, take a hike to the top of a mountain, basically get as far away from people as we possibly can, so we can look at the amazing vistas and listen to this idiot's conference call. I went up to him to get his attention and to ask him to knock it off. Karen doesn't like it when I confront people's rude behavior. She says it's rude. I stood 2 feet away looking straight at him. He turned his back to me and kept talking loudly. So I took a few pictures of him to make him even more uncomfortable, and we hiked down the mountain. This was not the first or even the 10th time we've experienced people in the middle of a national park talking loudly on their cell phones. When we spent the night at Crater Lake Lodge, I woke up startled at 6:30 a.m. thinking someone was in our room. We were on the second floor and slept with the window open. A man was talking loudly on his cell phone right below our window. He went on and on. Yesterday we went for a hike and saw a squirrel. Then we saw another squirrel. No, we don't know if it was the same squirrel as the first squirrel. Then we saw a third squirrel. I leaned out the window, looked at him, and quietly said, "Dude." He looked at me like I was chipped paint on the side of the building and just kept talking. Why do people do that? It's like giving everyone else the middle finger. Why is there cell service in the middle of the wilderness in the first place? After Ryan Mountain, we drove to a picnic area and sat in the sun at a table eating our PB&J. The wind died down, and it was very nice. The area where we were eating had several picnic tables scattered amongst large boulders. The tables were arranged so each had its own semi-private area. A family with two small kids pulled into the parking lot, and with great effort and drama, unloaded their kids, cooler, toys, diaper bag, etc. After they arranged their picnic area just the way they wanted, they walked over to our picnic area so their kids could climb on the rocks right next to us. Now, I know you're probably thinking I'm a bit antisocial after the cell phone rant, but come on. They had rocks to climb on in their own picnic area. Why were they over here? I wanted to offer to trade them spots. Obviously, they wanted to be in our picnic area rather than theirs. Karen said, "No, that would be rude." I took some deep breaths and acted like I didn't see the dad turn his back on his 2-year-old as she almost fell headfirst off a 4-foot rock just a few feet from me. I wasn't going to offer parenting advice. That would be rude. I remained silent and polite. I placed a scrap of bread on the ground next to me. It took a chipmunk about 2 seconds to find it. You're not supposed to feed animals in a national park, but I couldn't resist. This brought squeals of joy, or terror, I couldn't tell which, from the small children, and an angry "don't" from Karen. Remember, Karen's not a fan of squirrel-like animals. I did it again. More chipmunks, more squealing, more "don'ts." This upset everyone just enough that the parents, with kids in tow, went back to their picnic area for lunch. For a moment it looked as if Karen was going with them. With lunch finished, we drove to the Lost Horse Mine trailhead and hiked the 4-mile loop. I really enjoyed this hike. It was moderately flat and went back into a secluded area of the park where we felt we were the only ones for miles around. As the loop started to bend back toward the trailhead, the trail flattened out along a dry wash. We kept seeing shallow holes in the sand that looked freshly dug. They were about 1 foot in diameter. Later, we asked a ranger about them, and she told us that desert tortoises probably dug those holes. We didn't see any tortoises on the hike. We've found that it's rare to see wildlife in the desert, except at dawn and dusk. On the last mile of the hike, we walked past all shapes and sizes of Joshua trees. They thrive in the Mojave Desert and are fast growers for desert plants. Thousands of individual fibers make up their trunks, which don't have growth rings, so it's very difficult to determine their age. Plant experts believe Joshua trees are able to survive in harsh desert conditions for hundreds of years. They look like a strange cross between a pine tree, a cactus, and a palm tree, something you would expect in a Dr. Seuss book. Karen loves Joshua trees. Tomorrow we're hiking Indian Canyons in the Agua Caliente Indian Reservation just outside Palm Desert, and then we'll fly home the next day. Your friend, Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject, number 42, Yellowstone National Park. Date, February 6, 2011. Dear Bob and Sue, it started looking like winter when we reached Bozeman. By the time we turned south onto Highway 89 in Livingston, we felt as if we were entering a deep freeze. Ice-covered roads, very few cars, and rest stops with unplowed parking lots. We're on a two-park trip to see Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks. Yesterday we drove from Issaquah to Butte, Montana, and got an early start today. At Gardiner, we entered Yellowstone National Park through the famous Roosevelt Arch. The Park Service plows the road from Gardiner to Mammoth Hot Springs and a couple of miles beyond. They also plow the road into the Lamar Valley east of Mammoth. Those are the only roads in the park that are open from mid-October to mid-May. Otherwise, travel through the park is limited to snow coach or snowmobile. We reached Mammoth Hot Springs Hotel by midday, too early to check in, but we tried anyway. The woman at the front desk said she could do the paperwork and give us our keys later. She told us the rooms on higher floors tended to be warmer, sometimes too warm, and asked if we would prefer one of the rooms on the first floor, which tend to be cooler. We chose the cool room. I can't sleep if the room is too warm. With time to kill, we went to the visitor center to take care of business. There were few visitors there, so we pestered the ranger with questions about what it's like to visit the park in winter. He was very patient with us. At the passport stamp station, a young girl, who looked to be about 6 or 7 years old, was abusing the passport stamp. She held it like an ice pick and stabbed the desk, killing imaginary bugs. I shuddered at the sight. Her mother, I'm guessing the adult standing next to her was her mother, stood without expression while the child burned off energy. Every time the stamp slammed into the desk, I pictured in my mind the stamp image being mashed beyond recognition. Clearly, the mom adult wasn't going to intervene, even though it was obvious I wanted to use the stamp. I said to the girl, in my kind, soft voice, "Do you mind if I borrow this for a moment?" It wasn't a question as much as a notice. I was taking control of the stamp. I placed my hand over the stamp handle. For a moment, we both had a firm grip on it. She resisted for a couple of seconds, then let go. I gave her mom, guardian, a smile, sending her a silent message. "That's right. There's a new sheriff in town." I tested the stamp on a scrap of paper to make sure it was readable and the date was correct, which it was, and then turned to Karen, who was watching from across the room, and said, "Sweetie, do you want to stamp your passport?" I was holding the stamp in the air as far away from the child as the chain it was attached to would let me. The child undoubtedly expected me to hand the stamp back to her, but there was no way I was giving it up. The girl looked at her mom babysitter, then back at me, then back at her mom older sister. She had three choices. Wait me out? Unlikely, given her short attention span. Throw a fit? Likely. Or move on. Soon, the swath of bear fur laid out on the table nearby was too much temptation. She moved on. Karen came over, staring at me with cocked head and wide eyes, and murmured, "So, you're now wrestling the stamp away from small children, are you?" I handed her the stamp and closed my passport. The child was already bored with the bear fur, and was now molesting a stuffed prairie dog that had a do-not-touch sign attached to its leg. I looked at Karen and whispered, "That's right. There's a new sheriff in town." Back outside, steam rose from thermals a few blocks south of the visitor center. It looked like the aftermath of a forest fire. A handful of elk stood a few yards away from the smoldering landscape. Across the road, a lone buffalo pushed snow away from the ground with his head, looking for something to eat. We were anxious to get into the park, but it was getting dark, so we went back to the hotel and checked into our room. It was an early night. We watched the first quarter of the Super Bowl in the main hall of the hotel, eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for dinner, and then read in our room. Tomorrow we'll explore the park. Your friend, Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject, Yellowstone, Day 2. Date, February 7th, 2011. Dear Bob and Sue, we froze our asses off last night. This morning, when we woke up, the thermometer on my combination whistle thermometer compass magnifying glass read 45 degrees. This must be what the woman at the front desk yesterday meant by cool. I opened the door to the hallway, thinking that maybe the heat was out in the entire hotel. A wall of warm air greeted me. It felt so good I wanted to curl up against the wall and sleep out there. As I stood there in my pajamas, a security guard walked by. "Anything wrong?" he asked. "No," I replied. He smiled and kept going. It wouldn't have mattered if all the guests in the hotel were standing in the hall outside our room. It felt too good to close the door. Karen pulled the covers away from her face just long enough to say, "Leave it open." Then she disappeared again. For 10 minutes we laid under the blankets with the door open, waiting for our room to warm up enough for us to get dressed. People have given us grief about not camping out on our parks trip. Karen and I decided that last night counts as sleeping outside. At 7 a.m., hotel guests packed the lobby waiting for their tours to depart. Some were going on snowshoeing, cross-country skiing, or wildlife photography tours. Others were taking snow coaches to Old Faithful Snow Lodge, where they would spend the night. Another group was getting ready to begin a 3-day snowmobile trek through the park. Karen and I were waiting for a bus to take us to the warming hut about a mile away, where we would be outfitted for our all-day snowmobile tour to Old Faithful. Snowmobiling in Yellowstone has been a controversial issue for many years. We were hesitant about doing it because we'd read complaints about the exhaust pollution, the noise pollution, and how the snowmobiles are a threat to wildlife. But a ranger told us that conditions have improved. The snowmobiles used today in the park are quieter and put out less pollution than in the past. The Park Service enforces rules requiring that concessionaires use best available technology snowmobiles in the park. As far as the threat to wildlife, park rules require snowmobiles to stay on designated paths. Snowmobiles are not allowed to approach wildlife, and the total number of snowmobiles allowed in the park is limited to 318 per day. Finally, the only way to snowmobile in the park is with a guide. Even experienced riders must be in a guided group. These rules seem to have resulted in a compromise between the pro- and anti-snowmobile advocates. At the warming hut, they fitted us for our snowmobiling gear. We didn't need to bring our own cold-weather clothing. The tour company provided everything: full bodysuit, boots, gloves, and helmet. The bodysuit went over our regular clothes. Once suited, Karen looked like an astronaut, only in black. Through the windshield of her helmet, I could see the concern in her eyes as she tried to figure out how all this gear would come off when she needed to pee in the wilderness. Karen and I each drove our own snowmobile. It was more expensive for both of us to ride single, but we think it was worth the cost for the experience. There were 10 people and 7 snowmobiles in our group. Our guide, Cody, 3 other couples riding double, a single woman, and Karen and I. The snowmobiles were sleek and looked new. Each had a milk carton on back to put anything that absolutely had to make the trip with you. I put my backpack in the carton and secured it with a bungee cord. It was 20 degrees, overcast, and snowing lightly while we stood in front of our snowmobiles for our orientation talk. We learned how to operate the machines and, most importantly, how to adjust the heat, especially the hand grip warmers. Operating the machines was surprisingly simple. They're idiot-proof. I should know. Cody said we were lucky today because it was warm. They do this tour even when the temperature is 0 degrees. They cancel it when it gets much below that. We climbed onto our rides, started them, and followed Cody's single file into the park. Karen and I couldn't talk to each other while riding, but I knew what she was thinking as we pulled away from the warming hut, that we were entering a magical place. It was magical. The path we took was the main park road, Highway 89, south from Mammoth Hot Springs, the same road we've driven many times in the summer. This time, though, instead of riding on pavement, we were on top of 5 feet of snow. Since snowmobiles and snow coaches use this path daily, the Park Service grooms it, smoothing out the deep grooves and washboard ruts. We weren't a half a mile into our ride when Cody stopped. We all parked behind him while he pointed out the mule deer carcass a few feet from the trail. He said wolves made the kill yesterday. As I rode by, I could see only the ribs and half the hide remained. We continued south along the trail. The conditions changed constantly, from gently snowing to calm and sunny, to sideways blowing snow. There was one stretch of the trail that Cody called the Flats. It was a few miles long with no trees. It's always windy there. Every 100 feet or so, fluorescent orange poles marked the trail. When we rode in the Flats, it was a whiteout. The snow was blowing so hard that all I could see were the markers. I couldn't even see the snowmobile in front of me. Without the markers, there's no doubt we each would have veered off in a different direction and lost one another. It was a blast. We were cold, but even with the wind, it wasn't unbearable. The heated hand grips kept our hands from ever being uncomfortable, and the rest of our gear blocked the wind and snow. I wouldn't want to do this tour at 0 degrees, though. Not far past the Flats, we saw two large buffalo on the trail ahead of us. I know buffalo is a misnomer and their correct name is bison, but I'm going to call them buffalo. I didn't collect bison nickels as a kid, I don't eat bison wings while watching the Super Bowl, and Bison Bill wasn't a famous cowboy performer. The park's website says in bold print, "It is illegal to willfully remain near or approach wildlife, including birds, within any distance that disturbs or displaces the animal." That meant when we came upon buffalo on our trail, we had to stop and wait. The first time this happened, it was unclear to me what we were waiting for. Buffalo, I thought, could stand blocking the trail all day if they wanted to. Surely we weren't supposed to sit there forever. But the buffalo know the drill. They are accustomed to seeing humans all year round. They don't move quickly unless you piss them off, but they do move. Each time we stopped for buffalo on the trail, they eventually moved away so we could pass. Sometimes they would amble into the trees and disappear. Sometimes they would walk in the direction we were heading and move off to the side of the road. And sometimes they came at us. That's what they did on our first encounter. They came at us. We've seen buffalo on roads before, but always in the summer. Looking out a car window at a massive animal 3 feet away is a bit unnerving, but even so, I like my chances inside a 3,000-pound steel enclosed vehicle if a buffalo decides he's having a bad day and wants to let off some steam in my direction. Today, however, we were sitting in the open. The only thing between us and the buffalo was a thermal snowsuit and a plastic visor, and mine was missing a couple of the snaps holding it to the helmet. We stopped about 100 yards short of the buffalo and turned our engines off. Cody told us to stay on our snowmobiles, relax, and don't make too many movements if the buffalo came close. He didn't want us to agitate them. Nor did we. But he also wanted us prepared to start our snowmobiles and move away quickly if we needed to. As they began to walk toward us, it was hard to relax. Cody had been through this routine countless times, but we hadn't. They kept coming, moving deliberately. I took one of my gloves off and carefully searched the pockets of my suit for my digital camera. I got it out and filmed the buffalo as they walked past us. At one point, they were about 5 feet away. They looked forlorn. The fur on their big heads was encrusted with ice, like frost on a bag of French fries that had been in the freezer too long. But they are well adapted to these conditions. Besides, in Yellowstone, there are plenty of places animals can go in the winter to warm themselves. They live amongst the highest concentration of thermal features on the planet. If they want, they can find a steam vent and get facials any time of the day. The buffalo walked past us peacefully. As soon as they were beyond the last snowmobile in our group, we started our engines and continued. At Gibbon Falls, we stopped and walked to the overlook to view the falls. The depth of the snow created odd proportions. The small roof over the information sign had 3 feet of snow piled on top. The snow was deeper than the roof was wide. It was, as Karen would say, very Whoville. Farther south, we stopped to look at bald eagles and elk along the Firehole River. I joke about Karen calling her favorite places magical or fairy tale. But Yellowstone in the winter is otherworldly. Steam coming up from the thermals, buffalo and elk wandering by, snow falling. There can't be another place like it. It's something everyone should see at least once. As beautiful as it was getting close to lunchtime, so we saddled up and made a beeline to Old Faithful. The visitor center at Old Faithful is open in the winter, even though the road to it is not plowed for car traffic. Visitors arrive by snowmobile or snow coach. The Old Faithful Snow Lodge, across the parking lot from the visitor center, is open for guests in the winter. The area was packed with people. Guests staying at the lodge, visitors on snow coach day trips, and snowmobile tour groups like us. We ate at the snack bar and then went to look inside the new visitor center. It opened in August 2010. I like it when visitor centers have animal pelts on display. Karen thinks they're disgusting. I keep telling her that I'm going to start a pelt collection, but so far I only have 2 rabbit pelts, a gray one and a white one. Karen uses the white one as part of her Christmas decorations every year. She thinks it looks like snow when she puts her ceramic ski chalet on it. I imagine having an extensive pelt collection, with both a weasel and an ermine to demonstrate how some animals' fur changes with the seasons, and when people come to our house, I would give interpretive talks. I floated this idea with Karen, and she said, "You're not making our friends pet dead animals when they're over for dinner." In the visitor center, there was a wolf, mountain lion, and black bear pelt on display. I searched every inch of the mountain lion trying to find the bullet hole. I could never find the bullet hole on the display pelts. How did these animals die? Old age? Road killed? How did the Park Service get these pelts? I have a lot of pelt questions. There was still 45 minutes before our snowmobile caravan was due to leave. Karen said her snowmobile boots were too uncomfortable to hike in, so she stayed in the visitor center while I walked the boardwalks and trails around Old Faithful. Just as I reached the boardwalk in front of Old Faithful, it went off. How convenient! By 1:30 p.m., our group was together and ready to retrace our path back home. A few miles into our return trip, Cody asked if we wanted to stop and see the mud pots. We were making good time, and the group was up for it, so we took the short detour. It was a popular side trip. We were one of probably 10 snowmobile tours there. As we were dismounting, Cody said, "Make sure you take your backpacks with you or cover them up. I've seen crows unzip backpacks before." I laughed at his remark. I thought, a crow isn't going to get into a backpack in a matter of just a few minutes, especially not with this many people around. Regardless, I took my backpack with me. We walked the boardwalks and saw all the bubbling mud. Mud pots are interesting, but at the same time, I felt stupid looking at them. I mean, it's mud that bubbles. Karen and I walked back to our snowmobiles and waited while the rest of our group returned and used the restroom. There were several lines of snowmobiles parked closely next to one another. We were between two other groups. A man in one of the other groups got off his snowmobile, placed his helmet on his seat, and grabbed a granola bar out of his backpack. He then set his backpack on the seat of his snowmobile and started walking toward the mud pots. Just then, a crow, a large one, landed on the guy's snowmobile, grabbed the zipper loop of the backpack in his beak, and jerked it. The crow did this several more times, looking around nervously after each jerk. This happened 10 feet in front of me. In less than a minute, the crow unzipped the backpack. He stuck his head inside, pulled out an empty granola bar wrapper, and flung it. He poked his head inside a few more times, and then flew away, empty-beaked. I sat corrected. Now I've seen a crow unzip a backpack. Having seen the mud pots and crow tricks, we pulled out of the snow-packed parking lot and back onto the main trail. We were making good time. There were stretches where I think Cody was trying to see how fast he could get us to go. My speedometer read 40 miles per hour a couple of times. At that speed, I felt only partially in control of my snowmobile. I was planning on going faster when we reached the flats, but when we got there, it was a whiteout again. This time I could barely see the fluorescent trail markers. I was going 25 miles an hour, which is damn fast on a snowmobile, especially when you can't see where you're going, and using all my concentration to see the next marker. The snowmobile in front of me could have been 30 feet or half a mile away. I don't know. I couldn't see it. It seemed like we were on the flats for an hour. It was probably 10 minutes. Past the flats, our visibility improved dramatically. It was still snowing, but the wind was gone. Cody, at the front of our group, stopped and stood up on his snowmobile. He then continued slowly for a short distance while standing up, barely reaching his hand controls. He did this a couple of times and then stopped and got off. He walked back to where we all stopped. It was silent. There were a couple of inches of new snow on the ground that fell within the last hour or so. Cody pointed to the trail and showed us fresh wolf tracks. He thought he'd seen wolves on the trail in front of us. That's what he'd been looking at. Although we'd never seen wolf prints before, it was obvious these tracks were made recently. We could see paw details in the tracks, and with the snow coming down so hard, those details would have been covered quickly. We continued on, but at a slow speed. I could see the tracks on the trail next to us. The farther we traveled, the clearer the tracks became. Then the tracks left the trail and went up a hillside. Up front, Cody was pointing to the hill. As I looked up, I saw a bushy tail disappear over the crest of the hill. Karen got a better look than I did. Cody had us moving slowly after the wolf sighting, hoping we might see them again. The trail meandered around a rock outcropping, and we circled the area a couple of times. We were close to where we'd seen the deer kill this morning, so Cody thought that maybe they would stay in this area. We didn't see them again, but we felt lucky to have gotten the glimpse we did. The remaining ride back to the warming hut was short. When I shut off my engine, the trip meter read 107 miles. That's a long ride on a snowmobile. We were tired and walking bow-legged, but exhilarated by the day. This has been one of the highlights of our park's trip so far. It's something we'll definitely do again. Your friend, Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject: Yellowstone, Day 3. Date: February 8, 2011. Dear Bob and Sue, when we woke up this morning, it was 55 degrees in our room. A big improvement. Yesterday, after our snowmobile tour, I asked the woman at the front desk if she would please have the heat in our room checked. They found that someone, me, fiddled with the radiator in our room, preventing it from heating properly. Last night I stayed clear of the radiator controls, and we had a better sleep. We hurried across the parking lot to the restaurant for breakfast. It was -5 degrees Fahrenheit. It was sunny today, but I'm glad we snowmobiled yesterday. I'll take 20 degrees Fahrenheit and snowing over -5 degrees Fahrenheit and sunny if I'm going to ride in the open at 40 miles an hour. A year ago, Karen went snowshoeing in Whistler with friends. Ever since then, she's wanted to snowshoe again. Last fall, I bought snowshoes for both of us, and today we tried them out for the first time in the Lamar Valley, one of my favorite places in Yellowstone. It's a wide, undisturbed valley, except for the road that runs through it, and it's home to a herd of buffalo. In the summer, the road through the valley can be crowded with visitors, although it's rarely as congested as the other main roads in the park. We were looking forward to spending time there today without the summer crowds. I was expecting the buffalo to have vacated the valley for a warmer place in the park, somewhere closer to the thermals. But when we drove through the valley this morning, there seemed to be as many buffalo there as in the summer. There were certainly fewer people. We saw only a handful of cars all day. By the time we pulled off the road and parked, the temperature warmed to 0 degrees Fahrenheit. In our ski and snowboard outfits, we strapped on our new snowshoes and crunched across the parking lot to the start of the trail. We snowshoed next to a set of cross-country ski tracks leading away from the main road. The tracks followed the outline of a service road that was 8 feet below the snow. The snow was powdery and light. I kept sinking up to my knees. My snowshoes didn't have enough surface area to support my weight. Every time a leg would disappear, it took tremendous effort to bring it back to the surface. That was the hardest part of the hike. Karen floated on top of the snow with ease, looking back at me with expressions of frustration, like she wanted to say, "Quit messing around." It was sunny, with no wind and 0 degrees Fahrenheit, but we weren't the least bit cold. It felt good. Snowshoeing is hard work, especially in deep, fine snow where every step is a struggle. It kicked my butt. I was sweating through my snowboard jacket. The ski tracks went about a mile into the backcountry. After that, we were on our own. We could no longer see the valley road, and the only tracks in the snow, other than ours, were animal tracks. We didn't know what most of them were. Some were clearly the trodden paths of elk or buffalo, but others were tiny poke holes in the snow, like someone hovered above and jabbed a stick every couple of feet into the snow. We're guessing a fox or coyote made them, rabbit tracks would have been closer together. We didn't see any wolf tracks. After yesterday's encounter, we knew what those looked like. We came upon a group of elk. They were lying in an area of packed-down snow. The edge of their circle was just high enough to block the wind. They looked so much larger than when we've seen them through our car window or even from the snowmobile. Being on foot next to the big animals puts their size and strength in better perspective. We felt small. About 3 miles into our hike, we came over the crest of a hill. In front of us and to our left was a stand of trees. Halfway past the trees, I glanced over and saw an enormous head. I about peed myself. It was a buffalo, a big one. He was motionless, like a museum exhibit, but looking right at us. Karen said, "Don't make eye contact." Too late. His big black eyes were shiny like glass. It was just him and us in the middle of the wilderness. We stopped. At first, we were not sure if it was a good idea to walk past him, but we were already about as close to him as we were going to get, so we kept going. His big head followed us. Not only do animals look bigger when you're alone with them in the wilderness, but you realize how vulnerable you are. On snowshoes, we weren't going anywhere quickly if he decided to pay us a visit. Our only option was to keep a respectful distance and go about our business. After another mile, we turned around and started back, although we wanted to keep going. Common sense won. We didn't have food or water with us, and we were getting farther from the car. It wouldn't have been a good idea to go deeper into the unknown, even on a beautiful day like today. On our trek back to the car, we found our buffalo friend right where we left him, as if he was waiting for us. I was relieved he wasn't standing in our tracks. Trying to detour around him without getting lost in the woods would have been tricky. When we started our parks trip, Karen and I had a list of things we wanted to do. We thought we'd do them and check them off the list for good, but our list never gets shorter. Just like snowmobiling yesterday, snowshoeing in Yellowstone is something we can't wait to do again. Your friend, Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject: Travel Day. To J. Hole. Date, February 9, 2011. Dear Bob and Sue, it was 20 degrees below zero this morning, colder than our snowmobiling day by 40 degrees. When we were ready to leave for Jackson Hole, Wyoming, we were surprised that our car started without hesitation. In summer, the drive to Jackson Hole from Mammoth Hot Springs is 150 miles. About 3 hours. In winter, it's twice the distance in time because the roads through Yellowstone are closed. We had to drive north and west to Bozeman before driving south and around the park, approaching Jay Hole from the west. Karen and I have renamed Jackson Hole Jay Hole. We took our time on the slick roads and stopped at a deli in West Yellowstone for lunch. The drive was uneventful until the last hour. Driving over the mountain pass west of town, it was snowing heavily. The traffic was heavy and bad drivers made it worse. Snowboarders were walking along the edge of the highway and the prospect of skidding off the road into them was nerve-wracking. We were staying at the Hampton Inn in town. We walked to dinner, and being that it was numbing